This is a podcast of Cosmos Winter 2017. I'm reading just the very short articles at the front to get into the groove of reading and articulating. This is a Life Science mini article, and it's called "Flip Switch Creates Instant Binge Eaters." Mouse brains might point the way to unraveling the cause of eating disorders, Andrew Maston reports. So we've had two articles previously. Binge eating might be prompted by a neurological flip switch, suggested a new research on experiments that prompted mice to eat more than a third of their daily food intake in just 10 minutes. The mice pig out was caused by stimulating a little studied area of the brain for just a few seconds. Sarah Bing Zhang and Anthony Van De Pol of Yale School of Medicine in Connecticut has discovered the effect while researching the zona inertia, ZI, an elongated section of gray matter located in the brain's subthalamus region. It'd be nice if you had a picture of this. Simulating the ZI for just a few seconds produced immediately binge-eating behaviors in rodents. Repeated stimulation for 5 minutes every 3 hours over 2 weeks led to a greatly increased food intake and weight gain. Further experiments revealed the ZI cells also became stimulated when food was withheld from the mice, catalyzing the release of ghrelin, the so-called hunger hormone, known to stimulate appetite. When periods of artificial stimulation came to an end, the researcher also noted the food intake rapidly dropped at levels below the untreated mouse used as controls. The study, published in the Journal of Science, might provide an insight into binge eating in humans, the mechanics of which remains little understood. Zhang and Van De Pol suggested that ZI activation might play a role. They note that some types of movement disorder are treated using deep brain stimulation of the subthalamus, and hence also the ZI binge eating behavior is often an unwelcome side effect. Okay, so there's deep brain, you get the munchies when you get some deep brain things. I think in this paper, this magazine, they've also got a really fascinating article about optical fiber stimulation making. You can get photo stimulation there. Okay. Next article, Dino Drumsticks Revealed. High-tech imaging is revealing a wealth of extra information about the dinosaur origin of birds, John Pickerel reports. The majority of dinosaur fossils comprise only preserved bones, but a very rare case, scientists get a much more detailed glimpse into what these creatures might have looked like. China's Liaoning province is one place that regularly yields incredible fossils with traces of feathers, internal organs, and even gut contents preserved. Recently, researchers used a new method to reveal details of the body, skin, feathers, and scales of a dinosaur called Archinorus, known as laser-stimulated fluorescence, LSF. The technique uses a violet laser to make molecules in the remnant organic tissues embedded in the rock glow in the dark. Now, this is really interesting. So, yeah, UV laser. We were directly able to observe. So, they do that in crime scenes. You know, the police come around with a UV lamp and see, wonder what that stain is there. UV lamp. It's really interesting how that operates. We were able to directly observe parts of the body outline of the bird, like dinosaurs, said Hong Kong University paleontologist Michael Pittman. We also observed soft tissue details of the wings and feet that are usually extremely difficult to infer from studying fossil skeletons. Crow-sized Archinornis is important for understanding the origin of birds and of flight, Pittman says, because it is thought to be closely related to the ancestor of birds. The scans revealed foot pads and scales very similar to those seen on chickens, as well as small flaps of skin under the feathers on the leading edge of the wing. These are known as propatica and important for flight in birds. I really wish I knew more about that. Look, I'm going to have to tell people how to actually add more footnoted information into this. Drumstick-shaped legs and a thin feathery tail were also exposed. There are about 230 chiquiness and quietness specimens in Chinese museum collections. This meant that scientists had many fossils from which to select the best soft tissue preservation. Mark Benton, a vertebrate paleontologist at the University of Bristol, said LSF was a useful technique for distinguishing between anatomical features and artifacts of preservation around the bones, revealing previously invisible details. And Quinus study was published in the Journal of Nature Communication. So that's, I suppose interesting. Let's go another discovery. Modern rice emerged 10,000 years ago. New evidence looks set to settle the question of rice versus domestication, Amy Middleton reports. And that's a big question I have. The site of the first domestication of rice is a hotly contested issue, with several countries eager to lay claim. A number of locations in China have been put forward, as have the Ganges Valley in India, the southern slopes of the Himalaya, and the various places in Southeast Asia. Shangshan, in China's lower Yangtze region, has long been one of the strongest contenders. Archaeological artifacts uncovered there contain some of the earliest evidence of rice grown by humans. Ancient rice remnants in different sites have shown up as microscopic silica bodies called phytoliths. However, a type of wild or domesticated, it isn't always clear. So what the silica, this is little silica bits, I don't know what they are and how they're associated. Researchers have used radiocarbon dating to place these pytholiths in a timeline, but estimates they have been controversial because the possibility of samples becoming contaminated by older carbon present in the surrounding soil. Oh, right, so using carbon date. Okay, that's interesting. Okay. In the last study, a research team led by Xinjing Zhao, a geophysicist at the Chinese Academy of Sciences in Beijing, verified the age of pyroliths at Shangshan by comparing them with carbon dates from artifacts found in the same sedimentary layer. The team examined the structure of rice remnants and found that they are closer to modern domesticated species than to wild species. This constitutes the earliest known evidence of rice domestication. When the domestication of rice began in its homeland, China, it is an enduring and important issue to debate for researchers from many different disciplines, the researchers note. Okay, that's probably interesting, but sort of... Okay. This is just by Life Sciences, and look, I have to say there's no author with this. Getting high on their own supply, Life Sciences. What makes Sherpa people who have lived in the Himalayas for thousands of years so well adapted to the high-altitude life, able to function on oxygen levels that incapacitate or even kill others, as it inspired plenty of investigation. Past studies point to them having fewer red blood cells but higher levels of nitric oxide, which opens up the arteries to keep the blood flowing. Mm-hmm. It turns out, this is interesting because you put the nitrate under your tongue to open up your artery. It turns out, though, that a genetic adaptation for low oxygen environment affects the whole metabolism. Funding comes from the research scientists at the University of Cambridge monitoring Sherpas and lowlanders as they climb the Everest Base Camp, 530 metres above sea levels. For most people, hypobaric asphyxia, insufficient supply of oxygen due to low air pressure, sits in at 3,000 metres. The peak of Everest, 8.843 metres. Do you think that these will actually... We should get them to adopt the commonest way to modernise it. At any rate, above 8,000 metres is known as the death zone. Using molecular, biochemical, physiological, and genetic approaches to study the two groups, the researchers found that Sherpas demonstrated a lower capacity for fatty acid oxidation in skeletal muscles, along with more efficient use of oxygen, improved muscle energetics, and protection against oxidative stress. These metabolic adaptations, the researchers write in the journal Proceedings National Academy of Science, appear to be related to an enriched gene known as Peroxisome proliferated activated receptor. Well, okay. Another article here. Okay, 10 minutes. Mars and the giant tsunami. Once upon a time, massive tidal waves carved the cliffs of the red planet. This is interesting. Richard A. Lovett reveals. Scientists studying a region of Mars known as the Arabia Terra think they have identified the source of the tsunami that might have crashed into its shores millions of years ago. The idea of a Martian ocean dates to 1990 when Timothy Parker, now NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, used Viking's images to divide what appeared to be an ancient shoreline along the edges of terrain separating the planet's north lowlands and the southern highlands. So the Viking is a lander, so this orbiter as well. Scientists later concluded that if an asteroid crashed into the ocean, a tsunami was a likely result. Now, in research published in the Journal of Geophysics Research Planets, a team led by François Costard, a planetary geomorphologist from the University of Paris, Sud in France, believes it has identified a possible source of one or perhaps two Martian tidal waves. Okay, I don't know, I may have set this article up slightly different. Costard and his colleagues began looking for craters that might reveal location of tsunami producing impacts. Then they modelled how such waves could propagate using the described as well-verified terrestrial models. Now, you think that my major problem here is that if you've got an ocean, you've got a form of erosion, and in general we've had crater impacts. They don't last very long if there's an ocean there, so that would be a very interesting thing to, for water at all, just to check the ages of the plates, the planets. Okay, Custard colleagues began to look at tsunamis processes on Mars could not be exactly the same on Earth. To begin with, the planet's lower gravity should increase the amount of sediment the wave could carry. This means that for any given size tsunami, the resulting deposits would be relatively thicker. Also, a tsunami generated by an asteroid impact of the size estimated by Custard team would have been huge, unlike anything humans ever witnessed. According to the modelling, the waves near the impact point would have been 300 metres high. By the time they hit the coast, they would still have reached 75 or 80 metres high. The most probable source of the tsunami, scientists concluded, was a 60-kilometre wide crater about 1,000 kilometres off the putative coast. But it was also possible that the deposits could have been produced by combined results of two independent impacts presented represented by small craters closer to the shore. The research also explains bizarre features on the seaward end of some tsunami deposits composed of curving concentric ridges 10 to 200 metres high. They look just like ridges in a thumbprint. The explanation starts with the fact that tsunami would have come in two pulses. The first would have produced when the asteroid hit, shoving a tremendous amount of water out of its way. The second would have occurred when the water rushed back into the resulting depression. The water pulses would have crashed together in the centre of the impact zone and a giant splash rebounding outwards in a second tsunami, even larger than the first. You can see that when you drop. If I can advise you to get tsunami style things, the way to get the best tsunami is you get a pool and a balloon full of water. That makes a really beautiful thing, beautiful whoop of tsunami to see what's going on. I just have energy. Yeah, that is interesting. I don't think it's necessarily caused by the height of the water column. It's just the fact that you've got the incoming water column rushes through each other. That's just the beginning of the story. When the first wave, a few minutes ahead of the second, hits the shoreline, part of it would have been reflected back to sea. Then it would have met the oncoming wave, causing sediment to be dropped in patterns exactly like the geomagnetic thumbprint terrains. The primary value of the study, however, may not lie in localising the source of tsunami, but confirming the theory Mars once had an ocean capable of producing one. Okay, that's interesting. There's also, that should also show the first Viking lander in which I think the little rover, the first of this, I forgot what it's called, the Discovery rover, Spirit, where it trundled along this first crater, the first it saw. Okay, Call It Random, a game by Andrew Masterton, really working hard, Andrew. Even pretending to construct random sequences is a young person's game, Masterton reports. Codebreaking, at its heart, involves looking for lots of numbers and trying to spot telltale patterns that provide a key to decryption. Spies long ago realized the best way to create a truly random encryption is to ask a computer to do it. This is because humans are rather poor at creating lists of random numbers, even when they are consciously trying to do so. Some early cryptographers assumed that they could generate huge amounts of random keys by haphazardly tapping away at a typewriter, wrote physicist Simon Singh in his History of Espionage, the Code Book, Fourth State, 1999. Now, that's interesting. I don't quite understand that. Fourth State is usually the press, because you've got the first of the royals, then the merchants, and then everyone else is the third estate. Okay, looking for an insight into why randomness or apparent randomness is so challenged, a team of researchers in the Laboratoire de Recherche Scientifique de Paris, France, recently devised a series of tests and applied them to a pool of 3,400 people aged between 4 and 91. Okay. Each of the participants asked to complete a series of tasks in which required the construction of a list that would appear random when viewed by an observer. I don't know how your four-year-old does it. The task included making up a set of 12 coin toss results and inventing numbers that showed 10 hypothetical die rolls. The result published in the Journal of Computational Biology reveals at age 25 is the peak of achieving truly random-looking results. This experiment is a kind of reverse Turing test for random behavior, a test of strength between algorithms and humans. Okay, so you have to say a Turing, can I tell it's a computer? Humans, can I tell it's a computer or a person? Said co-author Hector Zennel. The findings add weight to previous studies that suggest, perhaps counterintuitively, that constructing a properly random list requires a high-level cognitive process. Randomness may be connected to cognitive activity, particularly creativity. I don't know how you get all this. So if you need to jot something truly random, what should you do? Singh advised, the best random keys are created by harnessing natural physical processes such as radioactivity, which are shown to truly have random behavior. Thanks for listening.